KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I am from Livermore.
I'm from East Oakland.
Oakland, near Lake Merritt.
Alameda, California.
Coming up, an in-depth look at Treasure Island's radiation cleanup.
My friends joke at me that, maybe one day you might turn into Spider-Man if you get bitten by a spider.
Then the power of letting young people speak for themselves through poetry.
Going into a space like You Speaks, where they were not only asking me what I thought, but they genuinely cared and took my opinion into consideration. These are the spaces where young people are going into and being transformed.
A conversation with Youth Speaks founder, James Cass. And we'll get a preview of this week's International Poetry Slam competition.
This is for the girl who asked me if I speak African. As if every country and tribe spoke the same language.
Truth, power, and poetry today on Cross Currents. If you take the Bay Bridge out of San Francisco and look down at Treasure Island, it's hard to miss what look like enormous piles of dirt. These mounds are actually the remains of old Navy barracks, ground into pieces, and now they signify some of the first visible steps in the long-talked-about Treasure Island redevelopment. About a year ago, the city of San Francisco broke ground on the project. It includes a ferry terminal, shops, restaurants, and 8,000 homes. It's a big deal for a housing-strapped city. KALW listener Jan Burnham heard about the development and thought about the island's past. The former Navy base there had notorious problems with its cleanup of radioactive materials. So she asked Hey Area.
I was wondering what came of the radioactive waste contamination that had to be cleaned up after the Navy left.
We sent KALW's environment reporter Angela Johnston to find out.
Our question asker, Jan Burnham, doesn't even live on Treasure Island, but it still means something to her.
I've always liked walking here. I think it's such a great view of the water and the city, and it's a beautiful place to bring people when they come to visit.
We meet up near one of her favorite spots on Treasure Island, on the west side with a view of the city. Palm trees line the paved walking path that circles the perimeter of the island. Burnham used to walk here regularly until a few years ago when she read a troubling article in the San Francisco Chronicle.
The Navy had used radioactive materials and they hadn't cleaned it up properly. They were warning people, residents here, that they had to not play in the dirt and not plant things. And I just thought that was horrible.
More than 2,000 people live on Treasure Island in former military housing. The city started leasing land from the Navy back in the late 90s. It's one of the most diverse zip codes in the Bay Area. I take Jan Burnham to meet Treasure Island resident Ben Reyes. He's rented here for 2 years.
Hi,
is Ben here?
Yeah, this is Jan.
Hi, Dad.
Jan, this is Ben.
Ben's a self-proclaimed science nerd. He carries a vial of radium on his keychain and tests his tap water with a wand before he drinks it. He's from England, and when he got a job with a tech company in San Francisco, Treasure Island caught his eye because of the cheap rent. Then he Googled it.
The first immediate articles would be, you know, there's radiation discovered on Treasure Island, residents suffering health effects.
When he first moved in and started walking around the island, Ben freaked out a little.
You see very clear radioactive signs. It almost looks like a post-apocalyptic scene with cordoned off houses, abandoned houses, military barracks, and massive warning signs to keep out danger, radiation. And that does come, it both intrigued me and did seem a little bit scary.
So he started carrying a Geiger counter, a small device the size of a Game Boy that measures radiation exposure. Ben shows it to Jan and takes a reading near her feet.
At the moment, we're reading 0.07 microsieverts.
That's about the amount you get when you sleep next to somebody for the night, just from the natural radiation in our bodies. You get a little more from an X-ray for a broken arm. You get 40 microsieverts sitting on a plane from New York to LA. Ben found this out the hard way when he brought his Geiger counter on a plane by mistake.
I didn't realize it was going off in the plane. It was going very loud, just like ticking noise. Yeah. I'm surprised no one realized. Yeah. I was just like, oh God, I got to take the batteries out.
We walked to an area behind Ben's house blocked off with radiation signs.
So it's picking up. It was a little bit higher than it was over there, mm-hmm. but it's 0.2 microsievert. So what do we see here? So still pretty low. Yeah. So we're now in between eating a banana and living 50 miles off a coal power plant for a year.
The Geiger counter reading may be a little higher here because we're standing where the Navy is searching for radiation right now, a place where the Navy buried radioactive garbage deep beneath the soil.
I'm definitely next door neighbors to a bunch of radioactive material by looking at the signs there. My friends joke at me that, you know, maybe one day you might turn into Spider-Man if you get bitten by a spider.
Ben's Geiger counter's quiet now, partly because the device doesn't read what's below the soil. That's the area of biggest concern because of the Navy's history on Treasure Island.
Once again, Bikini Atoll becomes the scene of the most dramatic nuclear explosion of all.
That's a complicated history. In the late 1930s, the U.S. government built the island for the World's Fair. The Navy took over in 1942, using Treasure Island for training. In 1946, the Navy tested the atomic bomb in the Marshall Islands. Radioactive fallout coated nearby Navy ships, and sailors didn't know how to properly clean it off. So the Navy started training them in detection and removal across the Pacific on Treasure Island.
For they may have witnessed a prelude to world destruction.
So let's go here, make a right. So let's stop here just momentarily.
I'm driving around with Keith Foreman, the Navy's environmental cleanup coordinator for Treasure Island. We visit big Art Deco-style buildings and boarded-up bungalows, radiation detection classrooms that house sources of radium and cesium. Up until the 1960s, the Navy disposed of their radioactive equipment and other toxic chemicals in a way that was okay at the time. They buried them deep underground in big industrial garbage pits, officially known as solid waste disposal areas. Foreman takes me to one that was just cleaned up.
And we're proud of this because this is the end result. The fences that were segregating this from the residences here are gone.
Was anything found in this area?
Yes. There were some low-level rad objects that were found.
Low-level rad objects. That's Navy speak for radioactive things. Tiny buttons painted with radium paint, small pieces of radioactive equipment. Foreman emphasizes the words low level. He wants to be clear. These aren't weapons-grade materials, and they're small. Foreman pinches his fingers together as if he's holding a dime.
And they're not willy-nilly everywhere. As of this date, I believe we're at 1,220 low-level rad objects that we found on the island. All but 17 of them have been in the solid waste disposal areas that you and I toured.
1,220. Way more than earlier studies suggested. The Navy admits now those studies weren't comprehensive enough. About 5 years ago, when they started cleaning up toxic chemicals like petroleum and lead, they found more objects. The California Department of Public Health got involved and found even more radioactive materials. Now, the Navy is playing catch-up.
Well, it's a step-by-step process of discovery, so you know a lot more now than you did then. Can I admit that we made mistakes? Well, of course mistakes are made in the past. There's no perfect process, and it's easy to understand why some people's confidence can be lessened by, hey, why didn't you know back then what you know now?
A few objects were discovered under the soil near playgrounds and under the foundation of people's homes. And some of them weren't low level. In a 2013 report, the California Department of Public Health found a radioactive fragment underneath a grassy area. If it were held for an hour, it could cause radiation burns, hair loss, and ulceration.
I guess that would be a concern if it were ever in contact with somebody. Again, you're talking about things that were found at depth.
I've submitted Freedom of Information requests to get the most up-to-date info. In the meantime, Foreman says confidently, the Navy shouldn't find any more radioactive objects outside of the three garbage pits. And as long as Treasure Island residents obey their lease rules and don't dig in their backyards, Foreman says they should be fine.
It's not presenting any unacceptable risks to people who work here, people who live here, people who recreate here.
I take these assurances to Kai Vetter, a health physicist at UC Berkeley. When we talk, he's just returned from Fukushima and is about to fly to Chernobyl.
What is fascinating is Treasure Island is indeed not Fukushima Chernobyl, but is right at our doorstep.
And he says things like an earthquake or a bunch of rain like we had this winter can move soil around. Same with future construction and development on the island.
There will be enormous amount of digging and removal and changing of soil, which then would potentially expose these radioactive materials and sources.
And even though most of these objects are low level, Vetter says they're still unsafe in the wrong hands.
The potential is that you put it in your mouth, which of course will happen for small children who run around and squall around in the areas in their sandboxes and whatever, and find that and put it in your mouth. So then you ingest that material, and then the major damage starts.
Now, it's hard to make a direct correlation between health problems like cancer and radiation exposure, unless a huge portion of the population gets sick. But Vetter says what's almost more dangerous than the potential for radiation exposure is the way the Navy communicates and builds trust with the public.
One effect, health effect, one can certainly absolutely measure in Fukushima is not due to the direct effect of radiation, but the indirect effect due to the psychological impact. So the fear of the unknown, the fear of how much exposure I got, what is the fear about the future, the uncertainty about the future, that is causing an absolutely measurable health effect in Fukushima, in Japan.
He says the same goes for Treasure Island. They need to gather and disseminate good data.
Here, certainly, it could have been done better, in my personal opinion, to keep or to regain the trust in the public who will be exposed to that risk.
Definitely is an interesting place to live, though.
Ben Reyes tucks his Geiger counter into his bag. I follow him back to his house, along with Jan Burnham, the woman who originally asked KALW about radiation on Treasure Island. Ben turns to Jan and asks,
knowing what you know now, what's your opinions, and are you more fearful or of what's potentially lurking, the hidden treasures lurking beneath Treasure Island?
I still have a lot of questions. I don't think I would want to live here until I knew more. Yeah.
And what do you think about like myself or even some of the people here that, you know, might not have the resources or the means to live other places just because it's, you know, there's also subsidized housing here, you know, affordable housing.
Well, I just think that's a sad situation, you know, that people who can't afford to live in San Francisco have to live in a place that's possibly jeopardizing their health. And I think everybody has the right to, should have the right to have a safe place to live and affordable. So I understand why people want to live here, but I would just want to know more.
Ben says that, yes, there's a constant worry about radiation in the back of his mind. But he has his Geiger counter, he has stable housing. And he's more worried about what will happen when the city demolishes his apartment to make way for the new development San Francisco hopes to complete in the next two decades. Residents who've been on Treasure Island longer than 10 years will get relocation assistance. He's likely to get kicked out with very little help. On Treasure Island, I'm Angela Johnston for Cross Currents.
That story was part of Hey Area. You ask the questions and we find the answers. If you've got something you'd like a KALW reporter to investigate, go to KALW.org and look for the box that says Hey Area. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. More than 20 years ago, writer and educator James Cass was in grad school at SF State, and he had a small idea, a writing workshop for city teenagers. He felt that youth, especially youth of color, were misunderstood by the larger culture, and he wanted to give them an outlet to speak for themselves. He had no clue how big that idea would get. Today, his organization, Youth Speaks, serves about 200,000 young people nationwide every year. Programs range from the original poetry writing and performance workshops to theater productions and partnerships with investigative journalists. This weekend, Youth Speaks brings together young wordsmiths from around the world for the 20th annual Brave New Voices Poetry Slam Festival. James Cass and Brandon Santiago, a Youth Speaks alum and teacher, talked with KALW's Jen Chien.
What do you think are some of the barriers for young people's voices being heard today?
Well, I think, you know, Brandon might have some different answers, but for me, for 20 years, one of the greatest challenges we've had, other than fundraising and the normal nonprofit stuff, is the way young people are portrayed in the mainstream media and how young people often buy into that and are boxed into it at first. I can't tell you how many times we've gone out to a public high school and brought poets to perform and sort of model the art form and invite young people to participate, and we turn the mic over to them. And a young person, typically a young man, will get up and just read something, say something that's misogynistic, that's slightly homophobic, that's this, that's that, because that's what they've been told they're supposed to sound like when they're on the microphone. And then also, of course, the way that you're a 16-year-old African-American girl from Bayview Hunters Point. This is who you're supposed to be. You're a 13-year-old Latino kid from East Oakland. This is how you're supposed to be. You're a 15-year-old queer kid from San Francisco. The way young people are boxed by, I think, the mainstream media primarily, but also how they box themselves in based on that, that to me is the thing that we're constantly working through. And we talk in our mission about shifting perceptions of young people, and that also is shifting young perceptions of young people, their own perception and perceptions amongst each other. Actually getting kids to know each other, but actually getting kids to know themselves too is a big thing.
Brandon, what do you think about that question?
Personally speaking, I think the biggest thing was I didn't know spaces like this existed in terms of a safe space where a young person like myself can actually be welcomed and listened to and have adults not only listen to me, but also care about what I was saying. I think the only time adults really listened to me was in classrooms or in a library or at church, when most of the time they were saying, okay, stop talking now or leave. And so going into a space like You Speaks where they were not only asking me what I thought, but they genuinely cared and took my opinion into consideration. These are the spaces where young people are going into and being transformed.
Let's talk about your personal history with Youth Speaks. So you're a real Youth Speaks success story, we could say. You were a high school dropout.
Yeah, definitely. Dropped out of high school a couple of times.
A couple of times.
Yeah, you know, the first time didn't feel right, so I thought I'd try it again. The second time didn't feel right either, but you know, I'd already made my decision, but yeah.
And then what happened? So where did you grow up?
Cool. So I grew up in San Francisco in the Lakeview District, more of the western side of San Francisco, historically black neighborhood. At the time, there was a big... a lot of violent crimes taking place between Lakeview and Sunnydale. I went to Balboa High School, and in the 3 years that I was there, you know, a student got shot inside of a classroom. We lost a couple of students on the bus as they were heading home. It just was a lot of trauma that young people were experiencing. And so for me, I experienced this trauma on multiple levels, and it led to decisions that I made. And eventually I said, you know what, school's not for me. I don't feel safe here. I don't feel valued here. And as a young person, I didn't know how to communicate that, but I knew what I felt. I knew that I didn't feel valued in classrooms. I knew I didn't feel safe in classrooms. So I decided to drop out, and I decided to go to the place where I felt valued. I didn't necessarily feel safe, but I spent a lot of time, you know, on the block, on the corner. And for me, it wasn't a place that I felt safe, but it's a place I felt like I had a voice and an opinion and that I was valued. And so, you know, for most of my high school days, that's where I was at. I was doing things like that until I got introduced to You Speaks. I decided to write my first real poem about my little sister and about climate change. And it kind of changed the trajectory of how I saw literacy arts, how I saw spoken word, and really how I saw my voice show up in spaces and places.
I'm speaking with James Cass, founder and executive director of Youth Speaks, and Brandon Santiago, former participant and teacher for Youth Speaks. So I'd like to ask both of you this question. Brandon, you are working on your master's in education, or are you?
Yeah, I'm currently at USF working on my master's in international and multicultural education. Yeah.
So I'd like to ask both of you, what are the differences for you, Brandon, in what you're learning in terms of pedagogy or approaches to working with young people and what you practiced as part of Youth Speaks? And James, maybe you can speak to that in terms of, you know, how you've developed this approach to teaching.
I think the first thing is the idea of a first sound is that we give young people a space to share and recognize the first time they hear their own voice. And oftentimes in graduate school, when we deal with young people, we kind of tend to almost placate them a little bit. It's like, well, you know what, we've listened to you and you've been listened to and we want to hear more from you, as opposed to saying, you know what, maybe you haven't been listened to and maybe you are hearing yourself speak for the first time, and that's okay. And we're not only going to allow you and give you a space to speak, but we're also not going to censor you. Now, we also say that, you know, one of the things about real life is that you're going to be held accountable for your words, and that comes up and shows up in many different ways.
Yeah, I mean, we don't censor young people, but we challenge them. And I think that's a really important part of our pedagogy as well. And even we talk about creating safe spaces to challenge young people to find their voice. Your voice matters, but only as much as the voice of the people next to you matter as well. And that collectively, we're creating culture either in a classroom or in a theater or in media or whatever it might be. But it's that sort of opportunity for each of us to be involved in actually shifting and creating culture. So as we've evolved over the years, I think we've refined our practices more and more to challenge young people to get at what it is they're really saying. Like, one of the most powerful questions we ask in our workshop space is, what do you mean by what you just said? Like, you know, not, I don't want to just hear the words that you heard out in the media, or you're mimicking something, or the thing that you think is true on the surface. Like, let's dig deeper. So when we talk about challenging young people, like when we talk about a safe space, that means it is really important that there's a relationship between the peers and between the adults and the young people in the room, that we can honestly push somebody to get to their best.
That was Youth Speaks founder and executive director James Cass and Brandon Santiago, a Youth Speaks alum and teacher, talking with KALW's Jen Chien. James Cass has announced that this will be his last year leading the organization. Starting Thursday, the International Youth Poetry Slam Festival Brave New Voices comes to the Bay Area with 3 days of workshops, town halls, and of course, poetry slams in Oakland and in Berkeley. And the Grand Slam takes place Saturday at San Francisco's War Memorial Opera House. All that information is at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. And for a taste of what to expect at the Poetry Slam competition, here's a performance by poet Ugochi Igonu from the Youth Speaks Grand Slam from 2015.
This is for the girl who asked me if I speak African. As if every country and tribe spoke the same language. As if a whole continent shared the same history and traditions. As if we didn't each deserve our own cultures. This is for the girl who tells me she wants to go on a service trip to help the Africans. She's not sure where she wants to go or who she wants to help, but she seems to think that showing up with her whiteness will cure all diseases in Africa and fill every empty belly. This is for the poster starring hungry African children that perpetuates this mindset. The ads that make Americans think that hungry kids are the only things that Africa has to offer. No, we do not all need to be held in the arms of an angel. I will hold myself. This is for the people who say, you've never even been to Nigeria, why do you care so much? No, Igbo may not be my mother tongue, but it is my mother's tongue. So when I tell her, Ezine, Ahurumginanya, I say it with pride. This is for all the silent moments spent with my grandmother where I wished I possessed the vocabulary to continue our conversations past Ibolachi Grandma Letimeru. I wish I could do more than greet her. I wish Igbo would roll off my tongue like ignorance rolled off yours when you asked me if my family had to hunt for our dinner with spears. This is for all the people who say they don't understand my mother even when she is speaking clear English. Know that she is not slowing down so that you can comprehend her. Know that she is slowing down so that you can enjoy the melodious tune of her accent. Know that she is slowing down so that you have time to hear Nigeria in her voice. This is for the grown men who called me Ew America when I dared to speak up, and for the middle school boys that said Ayo Kunta Kente when I tried to ignore them. This is a message from a girl who is tired of your ignorance, stereotypes, and impatience. A girl who has never left California but knows the Nigerian national anthem by heart. A girl who is not sure whether she is African American or an African in America. A girl who possesses all the beautiful Nigerian strength of her mother. This was my message to you.
That was Ugochi Igonu performing her poem African in America. You can find that and more from Youth Speaks at klw.org, and we'll be airing their poetry all week long. And that's all for the show today. Our Cross Currents team includes Nina Gensler-Debs, Gabriel Greshler, Zoe Liu, Lisa Morehouse, Ariel Plotnick, Judy Silber, Jackie Sajiko, and Andrew Seltzer. The show is engineered by James Rollins. The line producer is Hannah Kingsley-Ma. Jen Chien is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Today's local music is by Tao Nguyen of San Francisco. She usually performs with her band, The Get Down, Stay Down, but this summer, she's on her own. Tao Nguyen has a solo show on Friday at the Fox Theater in Oakland. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.